Hello and welcome to the Ad Fontes podcast. My name is Ansi Kamel. I am an editor at large at the journal Ad Fontes, and I'm joined as always by my two co-hosts, Colin Chan Redimer, the poetry editor at Ad Fontes, and Reese Laverty. What do I call you, Reese? The something of the whole operation.
Senior editor.
Yeah, he's the senior editor. He's the editor who oversees the whole operation. Anyway, I forgot what my phrase is. I'll listen to back episodes and remind myself. anyway, all right. So
don't cause yourself too much pain. Don't. It's not worth it.
I mean, yeah, that's true. I suppose listening to Colin is painful the first time. Doing it over and over again. Who needs it? Today we are going to be continuing our series in Oliver O'Donovan's Begotten or Made, and we will, come hell or high water, get through chapter one. All right, that's the goal. It's what's going to happen. I'm making a decision about my future, which we'll be talking about later. In other words, you might call this a revolution. Ooh. And in this revolution, I'm going to determine that we finish this chapter. But anyway, so
liberate us from the first chapter in our revolution.
That's right. We're going to be moving into a future that's glorious and free of pain and suffering and all that. Okay. Colin and Reese, I should say, one of you, can you please just briefly, like 2 minutes, summarize where we were, like where we left off for our listeners? Because some time might have elapsed since we finished the episode. All right, Reese.
Sure, yeah. So we're doing these episodes every other week, so you can go back and listen to parts one and two. So we're working through chapter one, Medicine and the Liberal Revolution. O'Donovan has been laying out at the start of the book his kind of picture of us now living in a technological society. So now we as human beings look at the world, we look at problems, and our way of responding to them is to respond in a technological way. That is, we have technology that is the hammer in our hand, and so every problem looks like a nail, and so we respond to things with that. When it comes to medical issues, we respond with medical technology, but that has sort of created a situation where we no longer look at things that doctors of previous generations would have looked at on their own as needing treating, but actually we look at things that previously would have been regarded as healthy bodies. And because they do not fit with our idea of freedom, because you want to be free of some of those constraints, we will intervene in and treat healthy bodies as if they are sick. And actually our medical obligation not to act, which is kind of the first principle for almost any doctor really, has been kind of superseded by a desire that actually we should act. We should always intervene in order to kind of make things conform to how we wish them to be. And we ended specifically with O'Donovan talking about the strange paradox and what is now a very interesting historical statement that no one could have predicted. This is on page 8 of our Davenant Press edition of the book. Of all the arguments which ensured the victory of liberal abortion policy in Western societies, none, I think, was so influential than the one which many of us who wrote about the subject thought too crude to be taken seriously, the woman's right to self-determination in respect of her own body. That's where we got up to, the right of self-determination and intervention with medical technique in abortion, having a kind of triumph that no one could have predicted.
Just to move us into the next sort of point that he makes, he, in talking about this paradox, he points out that the woman's freedom comes at the cost of the physician's freedom to abstain from performing abortions. He doesn't say this, but presumably he also means for us to think about, you know, the freedom, the self-determinative freedom of the fetus. You know, I mean, that's getting us into trickier metaphysical territory. But, you know, the point is that the assertion of absolute freedom on the part of one person leads to the constraint of freedom for others. And what he calls, so this is what the final sentence of that paragraph, he says, this loss of freedom on the physician's part points us to a contradiction which lies at the heart of the phenomenon of a liberal revolution in italics. And so then he's going to start, we're moving into a section where he talks about the nature of freedom, of communal action, of revolution in general. And so that's kind of where he wants us to go after this. So, so he talks about, he begins by distinguishing revolution from change. And I wonder what you guys, well, maybe Colin, maybe you can get this distinction on the table for us, and then we can kind of talk about what we think about it. So what's the distinction between revolution and change, or revolution and communal action?
Yeah, you know, I wonder, I don't know, but I wonder if he has in mind Hannah Arendt's conception of power as stemming from communal activity, that somehow politics is not just a deliberative process involving, you know, an individual or even a group thinking, but has to do with them doing things in common. I think in general, he's talking about like social change can happen as a result of somebody doing something, but you don't have the circumstances in which everyone makes their decisions or their actions don't change because individuals make decisions or actions. Somehow people have to respond to it. So you could even like apply this distinction to COVID policy or something. You can imagine countries where, and I know that this happened, I have friends in other countries where the leaders of the countries towed the party line in terms of what you were supposed to say, you know, stuff coming out of the World Health, you know, bodies and the, you know, national health systems of the West. And you had certain non-Western countries that like officially mouthed all the things that you were supposed to do. Please do social distancing, do this, do that, do that. But nobody did anything in response to that. And so therefore the conditions didn't change. You didn't have a sort of revolution. Whereas I would say actually in a place like the Bay Area where I live, you had something like a revolution. It's not quite a revolution, but you get closer to it. Why? Because they said the thing and then people started changing in response.
Well, according to O'Donovan's definition, it might qualify as a revolution in the sense that what he says is that change can happen for all kinds of reasons.
I don't want to call it one. I don't, you know, but here he might.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't want to get into like COVID policy, but one of the things that the thing that he thinks is distinctive about a revolution is that it's not when a community simply acts; it's when a community acts so as to fashion its own future.
Mm-hmm. And I think to act together en masse. This is the quote from the middle of page 9: to act together en masse in such a way as to fashion its own future.
Yeah, and then he distinguishes it from an event. So he says an action is an event which has a beginning and an end, and when one completes what one is doing, one launches it, as it were, upon the stream of history. So normally when we act, we don't know what the outcome of the action is going to be. We just do as well as we can, and then we sort of leave it to providence to sort out what the effects of that action are. And O'Donovan wants to say that revolution is the attempt to act in such a way as to determine the future. It's action for the sake of asserting our power, or it's an attempt to assert our power over the future.
Other kinds of change are like, you have a tsunami, you have an explosion of a volcano.
Or even normal political action, you raise taxes.
Normal political action, exactly. You raise taxes or you change the traffic laws.
Right.
These things are not revolutionary. Sorry, Reese, I jumped on you.
No, and that difference between fashioning the future and simply acting together in the hope that you'll achieve an end are two radically different things. And based on kind of what we've had thus far in the chapter, you realize that way of speaking, which we kind of take for granted, are let's fashion the future, let's build a better future, that language, building a better future, etc. All of that is kind of the language of technique and craft. Which we import into our relationship to, you know, the ultimate kind of circumstances of providence that are ultimately beyond our control, yet we bring the language of technique into that. Yeah.
Right, right. And I think it's interesting, actually, because his critique of revolution, it continues, onto page 10, and he has this sentence where he says, to act well, then, requires faith in divine providence, because one must hope, without the possibility of calculative proof, that what one has done will be used for the service of others rather than their hurt. And I think in this statement, he's actually ruling out not only the possibility of revolution, but really the possibility of any kind of utilitarian ethic, right? I mean, this is the kind of classic epistemological argument against utilitarianism, which is, you know, in a nutshell, utilitarianism is an attempt to maximize, you know, pleasure or happiness. I mean, there are varieties of this. And so every action has to be aimed at maximizing good outcomes, broadly speaking. But you actually, the argument against this is, the thing is, time is essentially extends infinitely into the future. You can't know what the effects of your action are going to be 100, 200, 300, 8 million years from now, right? Mm-hmm. So there's essentially no way of knowing what sorts of actions will be conducive to the good or to happiness for most people. And I think here what he's basically saying is that's right. Therefore, action, properly speaking, requires faith in providence, right? It requires the relinquishing of our attempts to fashion the future, because we simply can't know what the future holds. And so we trust that God will, in the course of providence, work things for the good of those who love him. Yeah, Does that seem right to you guys as an account of O'Donnell?
Yeah, he says that. So middle of page 10, revolution is a word which speaks of this assumption of responsibility by a community over its total future, a word which never entered the vocabulary of the West until faith in divine providence was weakening.
Well, there you go.
We could have a chicken and egg conversation there, really, between the two. But that put me in mind of actually reading that at the end of the speech which Her Late Majesty Queen Elizabeth II gave when she was still Princess Elizabeth near the start of the First World War, Second World War, should I say? Sorry. At the end of it, she said, this is a speech addressed to the children of the Commonwealth that her and her sister gave. She said, "We know, every one of us, that in the end all will be well, for God will care for us and give us victory and peace. And when peace comes, remember, it will be for us, the children of today, to make the world of tomorrow a better and happier place." So, again, what's the hope of kind of victory in war there? It's not, how many tanks do we have, etc., etc., what technique can we apply to this, but it's the providence of God.
Although, interestingly, even in that statement,
there is a bit of make the world of tomorrow better.
Yeah, you see how the, kind of modernist revolutionary impulse is even coloring the statements of the Queen. I mean, she has it joined to the language of providence, the kind of traditional language, but you can see the sort of modernizing monarchy, in action there.
That hinge point, yeah.
To be a good politician is often to sacrifice clear speech and thought. So no offense to your late dear ruler. And this is certainly, if not more, the case with our own politicians. So I'm not trying to diss on
clear
people from
emphasis on the country. Clear speech. Yes.
Yeah. I guess my point, to go back to the little tiff, the little disagreement that you and I were having, Anzi, is I'm just not sure I agree with him that this is what a revolution is, right? And for the same reasons why I might disagree with Hannah Arendt's conception about sort of collective action, having a particular meaning.
I actually totally agree with you. I'm like not at all confident that this is a good definition. I was
I wonder if this isn't just historicism, because this is a feature of modernity that he's talking about. I think he's right. I think as you explained it, I understand what he's talking about. I would call it historicism. This sense in which in modernity we have to fashion a story for ourselves because we can't accept that we're receiving a story from God. And we therefore are responsible agents for sort of making the story happen and come about in the way that humans hope it will come out, right? But revolution, and he knows this, had a meaning previously. And there, do I want to just give the word revolution away to people who are doing this activity in history that is sort of attempting to take the wheel from God? I'm not sure I'm ready to go there, but that might be taking us on a slight bit of a tangent.
Well, I wonder if it makes slightly more sense, or you can kind of get why he uses it that way, at least sort of in light of what he carries on saying. So if we go to the bottom of page 10 in our edition, a spicy bit where he disagrees with C.S. Lewis in The Abolition of Man and in the Ransom Trilogy all at once.
I know, it's great. This paragraph made me so happy.
Catnip for Anzi right there. So he talks about Lewis.
I actually don't remember what was in the paragraph. I just remember
disagreeing with Lewis.
It's got hearts and lipstick stains on the copy. That's how he knows.
Anzi O'Donovan written inside a love heart.
Oh no. Yeah, so what is his problem here? He says that the quest for freedom from natural limits is not the private campaign of a small technocratic elite. So in Lewis's Abolition of Man and in That Hideous Strength, which is kind of the fictionalization of the same thing, the claim is that the problems of our society are being driven by a kind of inner circle of people who are directing things, who are trying to push society in a particular direction. I think, you know, again, we're not here to talk about COVID policy, but there's at least a lot of people who talk about the COVID phenomenon in this way, right? Mm-hmm. And kind of on its fringes, it gets into very conspiracy theory, you know, territory where you're trying to identify the individual government actors or the particular right. government agencies, which are like thinking through the whole problem. And I do think that he's right, at least in this, that from the Christian perspective, where you think providence has a hand in this, you always have to be suspicious of the omnipotence of any given individual or group of humans.
Yeah.
And so at least in that sense, I think that's correct. And actually, I would say, I think that if you read That Hideous Strength, that's kind of one of the things that Lewis is getting at too. So I'm not sure he quite understood That Hideous Strength by C.S. Lewis, because the yeah. end of it, right, the point is this small group of people was not actually that powerful. O'Donovan's point, though, is that the liberal revolution as a revolution, as Anzi has well explained from his perspective, has to do with a community action, a mass community action attempting to grasp some aspect of the future and bring it about in an almost never ending kind of wave after wave way, right? So the description of COVID then would be, we all were trying to sort of grab an end, which was like the prevention of this disease, which would be ultimately just the prevention of death, and bring that end closer to ourselves. But of course, it always eludes our grasp, so we have to kind of reach out and grab again. So it's kind of the revolutionary aspect of it that doesn't quite end, is that the future you're trying to grasp. What's his line? He says, the total future puts an extraordinary burden on us. And that's why revolutions sort of follow revolutions.
Mm-hmm. I think part of the point he's making is though that, well, certainly what it put me in mind of is...
Sorry, the quote actually is at the top of 10 that I was looking for. To fashion the future is to refuse to let one's act go.
Hmm.
And so we can't just kind of do the one thing one time. It's not like changing tax policy. Okay.
Can I butt in here? All right, I'm taking a class on Aristotle right now, so you know,
ooh,
final causality is front of mind for me, right? And so, but I
you're
mean,
finally
so,
thinking clearly, I understand.
I'm gonna pretend that was not said. Yeah. So anyway, final causality. You know, for agents, for things that make decisions, that have intentions, mm-hmm. Final causality is just the thing that we're aiming at when we act, right? At least final causality with respect to action is just the thing that we're aiming at when we act. Mm-hmm. And Aristotle is clear. This is one of the few things that I think he's right about, that humans always act for some end. I'm teasing. He's right about a lot of things. Not as many as Colin thinks, but you know.
They're just all the same things that the Platonists say.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Where they overlap, where the Venn diagram overlaps, Aristotle's
that's
right.
That's what I don't see.
But yeah, so humans always aim at some end. I think this is more or less true, probably. but I guess the question that I would have for O'Donovan is like, you know, he knows Aristotle very, very well. I mean, if you read any of his works, he's a very, very good reader of Aristotle. How exactly is his definition of revolution, how does he disambiguate it from just, you know, general final causality in action, right? So what's the difference? I mean, it seems that there's a kind of, his definition seems to differ in terms of like the disposition. It's like, well, if you're trying to grasp the end rather than just sort of acting for the end. I mean, I don't quite get, you know, what the distinction there is supposed to be. I mean, we always act for some end. Communities, he says, act for some end. So what distinguishes the case of revolution? I don't know. What do you
Yeah, I mean, I think you're barking up the right tree. Aristotle himself, I think, and this is, you know, one of my pet theories, runs into precisely this problem, because he can articulate an end that humans don't seem to be able to grasp. That the happiness that we really are aiming for is elusive. And mm-hmm. and so how does Aristotle square that? He's really struggling to square that. I think Christian theology, O'Donovan would say, squares that, because the end that we're seeking, we can grasp in a relationship with God. what's going on with the liberal revolution is a community which previously had that now lacks it. Therefore, we move back into a space of basically limitlessness. And so we are sort of convulsed by our inability to even articulate to ourselves the final end that we're attempting to get to.
That's really interesting. So are you, so it's like we've lost providence, but we've also lost fate. And so what's distinctive about which the pagans had, right? So, I mean, for the pagans, there's no grasping at ends. You act for an end, but you can't, you just sort of recognize that ultimately it's the fates.
Well, note that they lived in a cyclical.
And if you try, the gods will smack you down.
They lived in a cyclical space that Aristotle himself knew was sort of ridiculous and wanted to find a way out of.
Yeah, I've been reading Loeth, who has meaning in history, this book Meaning in History. And so he talks about like the cyclical and then the Christianity inaugurates the kind of understanding of time as a line, right, with an end
right
at the eschaton. But I mean, so that's an interesting point. So maybe what's distinctive about our, maybe there is nothing really, our action aims at certain ends, our collective action aims at certain ends, but we don't have the fates to determine the outcome of our action, and we don't have providence to guide the course of events. And so what we're actually left with is that the nature of final causality when we act takes on this kind of grasping quality where we
itself is that which tortures us in a collective sense.
Yeah. And where actually the purpose of our action cannot be disentangled from the revolutionary impulse to secure our own ends. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's right. And to kind of make this practical, right? So to go from the theoretical down to the practical, if you applied this to history, you'd say, well, this is why in modernity we have these revolutions, but then what happens after the revolution? You just need this next revolution, right? Because the Soviets don't really do it. And so then, okay, well, let's try this capitalist thing. And that doesn't really do it. So then like Ukraine has to invade Russia and that doesn't really do it. And there's going to be some other weird thing that comes after that. And it's just this attempting through this kind of mass collective action, which is maybe indistinguishable from a certain mass psychosis because it lacks a conceptualization of the end that it's trying to seek. And that end still exists in a natural sense, but it exists in this way that sort of evacuates the meaning and the good out of the collective action at each step of the way. So then we like demand the next action, right? That's this wave upon wave phenomenon that you get.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so I think in the interest of time, because otherwise we're just going to be stuck on page 11 the whole podcast, let's move ourselves to the bottom of page 11 into page 12.
Well, I think Reese had something. Were you going to talk about curiositas, Reese, on page 11?
Yeah. I think that was another valuable thing to dig into. But he talks about the sin of curiosity. And this is after he's made his point about elites and that hideous strength. He says the problem with that hideous strength is it's all about the mad scientist, and that makes it as if the kind of the sin to find out curiously what extent human ingenuity can go to is just something that the mad scientists are into, rather than actually the mass, you know, people en masse, which is, I think, is possibly a fair point about the hideous strength. But there is that bit where Mark in that hideous strength ends up in the pub and he sees a load of kind of salt of the earth working class blokes reading the propaganda that he's written and kind of nodding along to it. Which, when it comes to the sort of extremities of, you know, the woke elite or whatever that, you know, conservative folk dislike, we can sort of sometimes reassure ourselves by saying, oh, but it's just a load of, you know, again, yeah, woke elites in university towns doing this, the kind of salt of the earth working class folk around me, they won't buy into that. But that just does not prove true as often as we would like it to. Because
so it's not the,
if
it's
the
not
revolution
the mad,
has been that successful, then it will have infected everybody.
If we connect this to what Anzi and I were just talking about, it's not the mad scientists, rather it's the discipline of science unhooked from its proper end that produces these phenomenon. You know, relative to science or whatever. I think if you say that, you can see Lewis saying that in The Abolition of Man. So I wonder if there isn't like a deeper conversation that needs to be had between The Abolition of Man and what O'Donovan's talking about, if I had to defend it. But anyhow, now I think
that's an episode you guys have Joe Minnick on, and I will, you know,
he's away that week.
I'll be away that week. That's right.
You'll put a pencil between your teeth and bite hard.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. So speaking of I guess following on the point about the abolition of man, at the bottom of page 11 and then into page 12, he talks about the paradox that the community faces in acting. And he says, the paradox is that the community's goal is freedom, but such freedom clearly cannot include freedom of action, which might frustrate communal action. It follows that we conceive our freedom passively as a freedom not to suffer, not to be imposed upon. It is the freedom of consumers rather than participants. I'll be honest. I really don't understand how he thinks that the second sentence that I read follows from the first sentence. So maybe you guys can sort of help me spell this out. But
these are the bottom two sentences on page 11.
Yeah. So the community's goal is freedom, mm-hmm. but the freedom of the community can't include the freedom to frustrate our future freedom, right? Future communal action. Therefore, we conceive of freedom passively as a freedom not to suffer, not to be imposed upon. How does that follow from the freedom? How does that follow?
If I had to kind of just abstract from the language and try conceptualizing it, he seems to be saying the freedom is as a collective action always has to have some goal, right? Let's stop COVID. But the goal of the collective action inside the liberal revolution is to act in such a way that maintains everyone's ability to act, right? To liberate them from bonds. Mm-hmm. The bond that you're liberating them from then is the bond of the community collectively acting. So it produces a sort of, contradiction to the liberal revolution by definition.
Right, the whole community is acting to liberate people, individuals, from the community. Yeah. But they're going to achieve this freedom through communal action. I see. Okay, now that's
the only way to achieve it.
So then the individual's freedom has to be perceived as a freedom to essentially be unmolested, which is what he says later in the sentence. I think the next sentence that I didn't read. The freedom to sort of not be imposed upon. Okay.
Which I think is why you have this dynamic. When people find it impossible to say no to some level of freedom within our liberal society, let's take the example of transgender rights. What is the reason that a lot of people, I think, do not want to say no to the T? Is because they sense, I think, some logic then working up the chain. That if you have said no to somebody sort of, you know, who's been liberated in the chain of liberal revolution, that may redound upwards to the chain, such that you may have to say no to other people or, heaven forbid, even to yourself. And so we are happy to let that kind of absurd, reductio ad absurdum, individual freedom run riot, because we know that if we start to say no, we may have to say no to ourselves in some measure.
That's right. And so some people have referred to this as the Nietzscheization of the left, I think, in analogous places.
Some people.
I know that that's a phrase. Okay. Many people who talk about the Nietzscheization of the left, it's a real...
Can I just say that that's a terrible phrase, Nietzscheization? Whoever coined that should be banned from speaking publicly forever.
What are the letters in the middle of that word?
That's, I know.
Just alphabet soup of a word right there.
Okay, regardless
of it. I like free speech, but that's pushing it. All right.
All right. So when, when Herr Camel comes to power, he can,
In American spelling, you would have two Zs.
That's who
Stez
Camel to you.
You have a Z for Nietzsche and a Z for Zation, and that would just be, oh gosh.
What I was wondering is, does this apply to this particular situation? You know, you can disagree or agree. If you get to a certain point, the paradox of the liberation of everyone and the freedom of action, which that liberation seems like it would imply, gets to a point where you have to ask, what is a governor doing? And a governor then is just making kind of arbitrary decisions based upon its will. about who's going to get what, right? Are you going to get to choose your freedom to not have to perform the abortion and continue being a doctor? Or are you going to get your freedom to have the abortion? And the role then of the political leadership class is just to decide its desire, essentially, over the spectrum. And that's multiplied across, you know, thousands, millions of particular choices and actions. And if you embrace that, if you say, well, that's fine, that's good, then you sort of fall into this Nietzschean space. As we get to the bottom of 12, he begins talking about modern moral philosophy. And so I wonder why, just on a one question I had on a kind of bigger picture level, why is it he seems to be going more and more detailed? He's talking about very specific things right at the end of that big paragraph on 12. Mm-hmm. He's talking about medicine. He's talking about the way we talk to one another in public versus private spaces. Mm-hmm. And then he takes a step back and he's like, is this just because he's moving towards his conclusion? Because he's like, let's now step back and talk about all of modern moral philosophy.
He does a lot of work in this paragraph from the bottom of 12 into 13 to tee up the illustration, which he's going to finish the chapter with, which we really want to get to in this episode. Let's make sure we get there. It's kind of where he introduces the idea of compassion, which will become essentially a kind of a vice toward, you know, in the latter part of this chapter.
His point stepping back is just to say, you know, obviously all of this, there's like a lot of modern moral philosophical thought, and we could talk about modern moral philosophy having various emphases. And then he says, well, some of these emphases are orientation to consequences. So there's the kind of consequentialist utilitarianism stuff that I was talking about earlier, or preoccupation with fact-value distinction. But what I want to talk about is the obsession of modern moral philosophy with compassion. And then he sort of moves us back into his particular example of medicine in the context of compassion. So Reese, did you want to talk about compassion a little bit? And then we can kind of move into the concluding illustration here.
Not at length. I think it'd be good to get into the illustration. Obviously, you know, it's a spicy thing to say, I'm going to take issue with compassion.
What's wrong with compassion?
Which, you know, would literally be to suffer with people, and you know, we think that is sort of a chief Christian virtue. It's sort of, you know, Christianity's kind of great contributions to the ethical fabric of the West. And isn't it great? And isn't, yeah, it was maybe something generally that women are better at than men, which becomes not insignificant in the illustrations he uses at the end of the chapter. So he then tees us up by starting to talk about opera. And I know, basically, the most I know about opera is what I've read and learned in this chapter. Whereas Colin, as I understand, as the man of fine taste that he is, knows a little more about opera. So I'm going to hand over to Colin to kind of see us into the operatic section of the chat.
I am a huge fan of opera. I visit the San Francisco Opera whenever I can. Had a next door neighbor for many years who sang in the San Francisco Opera, so would often get free tickets when I was young and sort of grad student-y and didn't
have the ability to afford going. Did you hear him singing in his house?
The first day we moved in, he came over and said, just so you know. And sure enough, you know, from his wall through our wall through multiple rooms, you could hear him, you know, in the living room on the other side of the house, pretty clearly, actually. So
I was going to give you a hard time for your obsession with opera, but that was just such a lovely story that I'll just let it pass.
I mean, obsession, that's going too far. I appreciate it. I'm a lover.
Even of appreciation. Okay. Anyway, continue.
All right. Yeah. Still deserves mockery, but a different
I'll
level.
I'll let it go.
Is all I'm saying. All right.
Yeah, so, right.
There's a couple things that are going on here that you're not going to notice if you don't know anything about opera. And Anzi and Reese both said that they tend to skip over this paragraph when they get to
it. I said I did the first time I read the book, and then when I've reread it, and then especially reread it for this, I've much more deeply appreciated
it. When I read it, the first thing I noticed is that he picks two German operas. Okay. And this is telling because English people, until Auden, essentially, ignored Italian opera. They tended to think that it was bad opera. And sorry,
do you mean German opera? You just said Italian opera.
Italian, these are two German operas. They tended to think Italian opera was bad. They ignored it, and this is because the tastemakers of the BBC basically made it made a decision that they didn't like Italian opera at some point. They just never played it on the radio. Fair. So, you know, this it's to such an extreme that Auden writes at some point that he's actually grateful that the BBC refused to play these operas because it prevented him from listening to it until he was over 30, once he was sort of philosophically trained and he could go and appreciate it. And so I think right there, we just kind of have this image that, you know, this is a very kind of normal English education that O'Donovan has, but he's appealing to these two things, I think, for two reasons. One, there's what he explicitly tells us about the content of the operas. But I think I think there's actually more there about what the nature of opera is. So you're probably familiar, if you know anything about opera, with the term Gesamtkunstwerk. If you've heard this term.
I know what it means roughly, but that's just because of German. I don't know what it means.
I do not.
For opera.
It means total work of art. And it's a term in kind of aesthetic theory that's about opera. So opera is the art form that brings together all the other arts into a sort of totalizing art. You know, music, for example, expresses not particular sorrows and pains and joys, but rather the essence of them, sorrow, pain, joy, delight themselves. That's what Schopenhauer says about music. But then, of course, painting depicts something else, which is the experience of seeing things. The actors, right, depict people. They move. The words are poetry itself. So there's something about the poetical form. And actually, the... You know, Auden, who writes in The Dyer's Hand about opera, talks about how opera, poetry in opera has to attend not just to the words, but to the syllables itself. So this totalizing work of art, right? One way of thinking about it is it's like virtual reality before virtual reality. When you know, it's a use of technique. It's a use of human techne and artistic ability, poesis, to construct an entire world. And so in a certain sense, I think if you love opera, you know, you could be critical of the artificially, the virtual reality, the metaverse or whatever. Why? In part because it's so lame. Like, we can do so much better than that. And opera is like, well, let's create a world where every syllable of every word means something and hangs upon a note that's either supposed to sort of fit with it in terms of how it feels, or it's supposed to be opposing to it and create a strange kind of frisson and tension in the listener, where all language is set to music, where all action is staged and crafted in an attempt to tell you, the audience, something. Okay, what are these two operas supposed to be telling you? Well, he says in one of them, in Mozart's, I think it's Fidelio, right? You have this story, which is telling you about, it's telling you a story about wisdom, and it's telling you a story about these masculine virtues, which are oriented to the right thing, and sort of love brings you together. And the opera itself, this is what he's sort of unstating but implied, is supposed to be like that. You, as a member of the audience, seeing Fidelio, are supposed to be seeing something made by a wise ruler, which puts you in a space, and out of that space, you emerge with a sense of the orientation of things in reality as they're supposed to be.
This is the magic flute, sorry, rather than Fidelio.
Sorry. Yeah. That's the magic flute. Fidelio is going to be... Yeah, Fidelio is going to be Beethoven. This is the magic flute. And Auden says in an essay called The Mythical World of Opera that no secondary world, right? So the opera is like the secondary world you create, can fully hold your attention unless it has something significant to say about our present life. So magic flute is supposed to be telling you there's a king, and the king represents God, and I, as the maker of the opera, represent that those two orientations in front of you. And, you know, you have this part to play in this comedic construction, which is good and virtuous and valuable. And you kind of go out from there and you can live that out. When you read, when you read and think about Fidelio, so you have to think about it not just in terms of the content, which he summarizes this way. He says, in Fidelio, compassion is driven to it and arms itself with superior technique. And so the point of the technique, right, is to come to the aid of compassion and strength over the enemy not lies like in Sarastro in its ability to appeal to nature, the way of wisdom, but in its ability to resort to artifice, the way of progress. You know, what's going on stage is somebody who's weaker uses a weapon, uses technique in order to get what it wants over someone else, over the old man. There's a revolutionary overthrowing of the old order that happens on stage. And what does it use to do it? It uses technique. Well, what is the opera? The opera is the maximal expression of technique in the arts. And so the point of me, the artist, is to get you, the audience, into the position to be ready to do this out there in the world. And what is it that we're actually going to use to motivate you? It's compassion. But, and this is what he doesn't say, but which I think you can see if you study opera, that compassion is manipulated. How is it manipulated? By technique. It's the technique of the opera that motivates the audience to think in terms of compassion for somebody who the old man isn't looking after. And so right there, you're seeing what the opera is telling you is actually also being enacted on the audience. I find it to be a very brilliant and generative sort of analogy that he's pulling together. And that's my sort of best explanation of it. It's like, you know, imagine virtual reality, but different. You know, because we think of virtual reality, most of our listeners probably know that we're kind of critical of Meta. We think virtual reality is kind of scary. You know, don't go move into the pod and strap yourself into the Borg. But you could imagine, I think, if we reversed the polarity of virtual reality that's good, where you can sort of plug yourself into it and somehow you engage in an artistic experience that's supposed to teach you something about yourself that's valuable, that orients you back to your wife, to your children, to your community, to your neighbors, and you go out from there, you sort of unplug from that experience, you just like you might put down a really good novel, and you walk into your life and you sort of actually feel happy, you feel better about yourself, you're sort of picking up the trash in your neighborhood because that's the heroic act or something like that. I have a hard time sort of putting exact words to it because I haven't thought that much about it, but I think that's the kind of thing that he's getting at. And you can see this kind of pre-modern form of opera that did that for the community, or at least, even if you want to say it didn't really do it because you hate modernity or something that much so that you hate opera, it was trying. It was like an effort.
Hmm. All right. Meditate on that.
I promised them I would have a bit on opera. That's my bit. And I got no response. So apparently...
It was a bit on opera, Colin, and I told you already I don't do opera. So, you know, I don't know what you're expecting.
I'll send it to my opera buddy and see what he says.
That's right. Send it to your... We can have your opera buddy on. You guys can have an episode about opera, for which I will also be absent. You know, that's... C.S. Lewis and opera, where I draw the lines.
I guess it has a sort of metafictional level to the illustration that O'Donovan's giving with that his choice of opera here rather than, I guess, other things, as well as the, you know, the comparisons he makes between the actual plot of the two stories. And it's
I think the role of Mozart. I mean, I'll put it this way. I know a Roman Catholic philosopher is a friend of mine who says, "I'll listen to Mozart, but I draw the line at Beethoven." And he's saying something kind of similar here, because these two authors are representing different ways of thinking about the world, the relationship of the artist to the church, the relationship of the church to the world. And they're doing it at an artistic level, not just, and you know, O'Donovan's kind of tapping into that. He's talking about the plot. I think it's also happening at the level of the art.
Yeah. Okay. That's really helpful. I think simply in the interest of time, I'm going to have to punt us to page 15. Although Colin, I don't know, you got us, you actually got us right to page 15. So I don't know why I'm saying punting us. That got us right there. So this
Anytime
is where
there's a paragraph on opera you need me to talk about for 5 minutes, Anzi, I'm happy to do it.
Anytime it comes up, we'll just go right to you, Colin. But yeah, so after the opera discussion, he sort of sums up his previous 14 pages saying, like, you know, we live not at the seed time, but the harvest of the modern era. We can see mm-hmm. more clearly than our forebears its true character. And then he just sort of like pivots. It's a bit of an abrupt shift, to be honest. He just says, he just sort of shifts and he says, well, now I want to talk about confessionally what Christians should, how Christians ought to think about this and how we ought to react to this.
Classic restatement of the thesis, right? Because he started by talking yes. creedally, and now mm-hmm. he's like, let's go back and do... You
know. Yeah, yeah. So this yeah. is where he just sort of unpacks what he thinks Christians should do. So the first point, the first thing he thinks Christians should do is confess their faith in the natural order as the good creation of God. And he says, to do this is to acknowledge that there are limits to the employment of technique and limits to the appropriateness of our making. These limits will not be taught us by compassion, but only by the understanding of what God has made and by a discovery that it is complete, whole, and satisfying.
Because compassion is going to demand that we go through the limit.
Mm. Yeah, that we go to the limit. But the problem is, right, I mean, we live in a fallen world. The things that God has made are no longer complete, whole, and satisfying, right? Because they're subject to the power of sin, right? The whole creation is groaning, waiting for the revelation of the sons of God, right? So, I mean, there is this, I get what he's going for here, I do, and yet there is this sense in which I'm concerned that he's actually not reckoning fully seriously with suffering as something that generates not only sort of theoretical, but ethical problems. Reese, do you have thoughts on that?
Marriage, it would be part of the, let's say, the natural order instituted by God. In scripture, we have obviously accommodation for the way that marriage is affected by the fall. We have grounds for divorce.
Not just the fall, God's curse. Right. I mean, God curses dimensions of the relationship between men and women. But I mean, I think that's actually important, is that some of the suffering that we experience is a result of punishment.
So where I'm going with it, maybe if we take in view what Adonan has said, we do not, if there are times where some form of medical intervention involves us possibly needing to break or push against what would normally be taken as a good and God-given limit, in the same we should view that in the same way as we view a divorce. Yet that is not how we look at those interventions, I think, is one of the takeaways we could make from this chapter. We do not view very sad, necessary forms of medical intervention as much of a tragic, brutal necessity as divorce may sometimes be. We, in fact, view those things as celebratory. I'll go back to my hobby horse for this episode. Let's say transgenderism. If we were dealing with one of the tiny percentage of people who are genuinely gender dysphoric for whatever bizarre reasons, we can talk about, you know, how you ultimately help someone like that live with that condition for the rest of your life. Whereas what we have now is living in a society with a social contagion where actually pushing against those limits is seen as a good thing.
Can I push you on that? I mean, I think the better, well, not, I shouldn't say the better example, a more difficult example would be, yeah, right. That's really all I'm saying. The example I would use. So let's think about chemotherapy. All right. So I take your point. The analogy with marriage is actually is very helpful, I think, right? I mean, divorce, Moses gives divorce, Jesus says, because of the hardness of men's hearts.
Yep.
It's an accommodation to our fallenness. It's not a good, but it's designed to limit evil. Right, in the Mosaic dispensation. Chemotherapy strikes me actually as similar, right, which is, you know, it attacks the entire body. It attacks, you know, it weakens the immune system. But it most especially, you know, it can... It is designed, or it's aimed at destroying cancer cells, right? But yet in destroying cancer cells, it actually destroys a whole bunch of other normal bodily functions, right? So we're actually attacking things that are good in order to heal the body, mm-hmm. right? And I take your point that chemotherapy is horrible. Anyone who's been through it, or who knows anyone who's been through it, it's absolutely awful. And yet, it seems to me that our disposition toward, you know, being cancer-free should be different than to our disposition of being newly unmarried following a divorce, right? I mean, I want to say that there should be that being cancer-free should be seen as a positive good, something to give thanks for, even if chemotherapy mm-hmm. is horrible. Whereas being divorced is not something to give thanks for, right? You might give thanks for the accidental sort of the accidents that attend divorce, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Safety, you know, in the cases of many women, you know, in particular, who suffer from abuse or something like that. But the divorce itself, right? It seems like not. I don't know.
I take all of your you know, grumpiness at this paragraph to simply be you restating your difficulty with appropriateness, which is again what he's saying here. He's just re-summarizing his argument for appropriateness, because the Christian
our first episode on this.
Yeah, you can see our first episode on this where Anzi and I get into it, and I think eventually in that episode I bring Anzi, if not around, I bring him a little bit closer to the position of enjoying the question of appropriateness, and here's why. Because the cancer patient who goes to a treatment out of an attempt to live forever is a different kind of thing than the person who goes to the same treatment out of trust in the ultimate wisdom of God, the fraction of wisdom of which the doctor has that he lacks. And so there's a different orientation to the reality that you're in, which can be understood as complete, whole, and satisfying in the sense in which we receive this stuff by faith. We receive that this is going to be the case in God's eschaton that we have a sense of trust in, which is why he says the next one, you have to give it to me because we have to move on. The next one, and you can argue with me in the next paragraph, which you will. As a good friend, I know you will. He says, secondly, Christians at this juncture should confess their faith in the providence of God as the ruling power of history. And so again, he's saying that why do we have this sense? He says we need to set limits to the appropriateness of our making. Why? Because of this God who we trust and who is the God of history. So yeah.
I have nothing to debate with you, Colin. I think that paragraph is very good. I just,
well, then you disagree really with me that first... I think you should disagree with me.
Yeah, no, I know. It's like when I think we're agreeing, you think we're disagreeing, and vice versa. I don't know, but yeah, my issue with the wholeness thing is just that I think he's rhetorically underselling suffering. But yeah, I mean, I think to your point that the argument that he's making in the first paragraph, at least, cannot be comprehensible apart from what he says in that second paragraph, which is that we have to entrust that God is the ruling power of history, and therefore that there are instances in which we actually must forego taking responsibility for something, because ultimately and this is actually, I mean, I don't want to get us too far afield because we got to wrap up, but what I think effective altruism, for example, misses, or what people who deny what Augustine will call the order of loves miss, is that ultimately the universe is not their responsibility. God has entrusted them with particular duties and particular neighbors, a particular family, and that ultimately we have to trust that he, you know, will sort
even my inner universe is not fully my responsibility. Thank God, you know.
Right. Who could clean all of that up, Colin? That's
it's in God's hands.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, and then what's the third thing that he thinks we should do? The third thing, you got to turn the
Christians,
page.
Christians should at this juncture confess their faith in the transcendent groundhood of human brotherhood. The groundhood of brotherhood. Why does that flow from the question about providence?
I'm not overly sure it flows from providence. This is him kind of
rallying. The first two seem to go together. Largely disconnected points.
But yeah, it feels more like it flows from possibly the first points of limits, and earlier on from kind of us being begotten rather than made. We said back talking about that in the first episode. If something's made, it is sort of subject to the will of its maker. In a way that something begotten is not. So if we are all begotten, we're all equal, and we talked about what kind of distinction do you end up making between a human being who is begotten and a human being who is made? Which, in view of the thing that prompted this book to be written, is people conceived through in vitro fertilization. I think that's why that makes an appearance here is point three.
I kind of wondered if I was trying to sort of map these last four paragraphs, and I wondered if it wasn't, God's creation, and that gives you kind of the commonality of all things, God's providence over all of history. And then when you get to humans tend to, in the modern world, this is critique, think that we're making ourselves and we're in charge of ourselves and our destination. And so, if you take those first two, he's denied you both of those things. Then the next question is, what the hell am I doing here anyway? And how do I relate to these other jerks I'm stuck here with? And therefore he says, well, it says brothers, it's a sense of equality among us as the creatures inside of the history that God has.
I mean, this might be too flippant, but I think that in these last three points, he's just saying like, we need to begin living as though we believed in God again.
Which takes us to the fourth point.
Amen.
There is a fourth point. Confess their faith in the Word, which was from the beginning with God and without which nothing came to be. The Word, which was made flesh for us in the person of Jesus. Really, I just see that as a restatement of the first three points, right? Because there you have the eternal Word who creates all things and made flesh for us, who is us, all of humanity, in the person of Jesus. So there you've kind of got the restatement of all three points in that sentence. Yeah. And I think, guys, on that note, we're going to have to transition to the what we're reading section.
We did it.
We read one chapter of a 100-page book, and it only took us
and now we have the goal to talk about all the other stuff we've been reading.
We made 15 pages.
Yeah. Amazing. All right, Colin, what are you reading?
I've been reading Friedrich Nietzsche's Beyond Good and Evil. I'm not sure if I mentioned that last time, but
well,
if I did...
Well, you mentioned that you're teaching Nietzsche, I think.
I'm teaching Nietzsche. And we just went over the passage where he says, there are no moral phenomena, only moral interpretations of phenomena, .. And that's it. That's like a whole chapter of his book, that little statement. It's an aphorism,
Nietzsche's
not a chapter.
So good. Yeah.
It's one of his later works, and it is certainly, he's the kind of writer where, on each page you can get an explanation of something that could take other people chapters. So he's, just in the first 2 weeks, we've got the eternal return of the same master and slave morality. He keeps spitting out these hot takes that are incredible, and it takes you a long time to unpack them. And so, in the Q&A sections of the seminar, I'll have students ask me, this question, that question. And I keep saying, well, we have to wait on that. It's going to take me like a whole other week to go over that, that problem over there. So it's always fun to read Nietzsche. And my basic thesis in the class is that Nietzsche is not as far from Plato as you might think. We tend as Christians to draft Plato as our good guy in philosophy land. And he kind of stands in our corner as our fighter. And then we draft Nietzsche as our bad guy. He's the heel, and then they go out there and fight, and Plato always beats Nietzsche, and then Plato becomes a Christian, and then everything's good, and that's where Anzi lives. But in reality, where philosophy is really happening, the truth of the matter is these are both very complicated and detailed figures who are thinking about reality, neither of whom are kind of perfect fits with Christianity.
No, I actually totally agree with that. My attacks on Aristotle are just a shtick that I, put on for the Davenant audience. I'm learning about Aristotle right now. We're doing a deep dive into Physics Book 8. It's going to be awesome. He's really interesting. People
great.
Should read him. He's just not...
Is that what you've been reading?
No. Well, I mean, I will be reading it. But no, I've recently been reading... I read Cormac McCarthy's new books. So The Passenger and then Stella Maris, I think is what the second one is called. And you can tell that he knows it's going to be his swan song. I mean, just there's so much more explicit philosophy in these books. I mean, it was really kind of extraordinary. I mean, the man is extremely well read. He's not a half bad philosopher either. I mean, he's not
a novelist.
Right. I mean, but for a philosophical novel, you know, he's making arguments in, you know, I mean, in ways that, that are.
He has an argument about consciousness that's pretty interesting.
He has a really good argument about consciousness. He has a great argument about the relationship between thoughts and speech. And he basically like attacks the linguistic. I don't even know what the.
Correspondence theory.
The what?
The correspondence theory.
Yeah, correspondence theory, but also the linguistic constructivists who think that like language is the precondition for thought. He has this quip where he says, one of the characters says, when you say, I don't know how to put this, what is the this you're trying to put? You know, I mean, the point is that the thought is there that before the verbal formulation, before the conceptual apparatus, you know, sort of comes in and helps you articulate it. Anyway, really good, very dark. Would recommend it to our readers who can handle, you know, basically Nietzsche. If you think that you can handle Nietzsche without, you know, danger to yourself, which almost, I mean, no one
actually,
can really.
I would say it's even farther than that. But strictly because there are descriptions of suicide that are detailed. So just
that, like, oh, right, at the very end. It gets very, yes, that is true. That is true. Yeah. It gets very dark at the very end. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's true.
Philosophically, but anyway, it's where Nietzsche is. Descriptively, it's a little bit farther.
That's right. That's right. But anyway, I think it's absolutely brilliant and would, with those huge caveats, highly recommend the books. I think they're phenomenal. So,
Reese, what are you reading?
Me, yes. Oh, I'll pick things up and cheer everybody up. I've been reading a big book I have right here next to me called Stories with Intent. A Comprehensive Guide to the Parables of Jesus by Klein R. Snodgrass.
I love so that name.
This is Snodgrass. Klein Snodgrass. Yeah, well, this is a sort of subtle way of saying I've been reading the Bible. We're doing the parables from Matthew with our church youth group, and there is actually surprisingly little literature in terms of kind of commentaries and stuff focusing specifically on the parables. You know, you could get a commentary on Matthew or etc. But this is one of the only kind of real ones out there. And it's a great textbook in many ways. It kind of comprehensive all the parables. It goes into background literature and comparable ancient Near East and stuff and whatnot. So a lot of very, very good stuff in there. It's a great resource. I borrowed it, actually, because it's expensive. He is far too sniffy towards allegory. And far too sniffy towards kind of intertextual echoes and, you know, the kind of exciting juju we get from our colleague Alistair Roberts. So very good at laying out basic details, but a bit pedestrian. But if you're going to do the parables, go and get it on your shelf. But search further afield for more discerning exegetes. It's a classic biblical studies book. Just doesn't have enough theology in it.
Got it. Yeah. Well, I don't think between telling people, you know, you're gonna want to off yourself if you read this, and this book is dull. We're not moving a lot of paper today on this podcast, but here we are. Sometimes that's what a reading week is like, right?
Yeah, that's right. All right, Reese. Spotlight us.
Yeah, we are going to spotlight again today a book we devoted a whole episode to a couple of weeks ago, but which is will now be out in the wild, which is The Shining Human Creature, the first volume of The Christian Ethics of Thomas Traherne. We did do an episode on that a couple of weeks ago, modernized and edited by our very own Colin Chan-Redimer. Yep, it is out now in the Davenant Press bookstore. If you missed that episode, go back to find out a bit about what it's about. Colin, if you had an elevator pitch for this book, and it's a short book, what would it be?
It is an excellent example of the 17th century interest in the virtue ethics tradition that Aristotle bequeathed to the Western tradition. That the Protestant church, you know, once had going in spades and has since, you know, not entirely lost. It's never been entirely lost, but at least the Roman Catholic apologetic position is that if you want, you know, Aristotle and virtue ethics, you need to come to Rome, and it just ain't so. So there you go.
You can get bad philosophy right here, right now. Yeah. In Protestantism. I'm teasing.
That is certainly true. You won't get it from this book, however.
That's right. All right. And with that, if you liked this podcast, podcast, please give us a 5-star review on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And Colin, if they didn't like this podcast, what should they do?
If you didn't like this podcast, you need to read not one, but two works by Friedrich Nietzsche on Wagner. And then you need to go watch Wagner for yourself. Actually, Lohengrin is coming to the San Francisco Bay Area. You can come with me. I'll go with you, actually. That'd be very fun. I like my audience. Could be fun. And after you're done, you can then claim that you really understand opera and explain to us in a 1-star review exactly why I explained it poorly and was wrong about it, and why O'Donovan is wrong about it as well, and what we all should have said about opera. And that'll be your 1-star review for this week.
Love it. All right. And with that, we are the editors. This is the Ad Fontes podcast. We will see you next week.